There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, Mine website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or a banking day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from our website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 4 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, February the 23rd. First, I'll be talking to Matt Vitale, co-founder and CEO of Birchall, Australia's leading equity crowdsource funding platform, which has just released its equity crowdsource funding industry report. And I'm talking to Indeed economist Callum Pickering about the latest unemployment figures. But first, let's talk to Matt Vitale.
Matt, what did your report show about crowdsource funding?
Stability and resilience in some pretty challenging times for fundraising, particularly for early stage businesses. But pleasingly, what we do is still relatively new in Australia, and we've shown that it is an increasingly reliable and increasingly popular way for early stage businesses to build communities and raise capital online.
I mean, and that would be great for startups, wouldn't it?
Indeed. But I think, as we've seen, it's broader than just startups and innovative businesses. There's been early stage businesses and all small businesses. I suppose we have a vision that all offers should be crowdsourced funding offers, and that this is a very practical way that entrepreneurialism can be supported and fueled in Australia.
Particularly with the banks clamping down.
Absolutely. And equity capital is typically the hardest piece of the capital stack to solve. And you know, for early stage businesses, like, they don't even have, you know, debt and a lot of these other things available to them. So they're using financial products that aren't appropriate for what they're doing, where, you know, but you do what you have to do. You max out credit cards, you remortgage the house, you do all of these things. But the revelation has been that early stage businesses can raise equity capital, something that has historically been only the domain of large, typically listed businesses. These are small businesses that are making public offers of securities.
And this would be particularly acute in a place like Australia, where venture capital is not that active compared, you know, I mean, they're active in things like mining, for example, but not that active in other sectors.
I think that's right. And notwithstanding that the progress of Australia's tech and innovation scene, particularly over the last 10 years, has been phenomenal. Often, you know, we compare ourselves to some of the larger ecosystems and particularly the States. But it's the largest pool of venture capital on the planet, and there is money that just needs to be put to work, and it finds these venture opportunities. But in Australia, we don't have that mindset. We're not set up in that way, but equity crowdfunding is a great way to unlock a larger investment universe. And I think increasingly, people that are investing in other asset classes, they don't quite know how to get exposure to early stage venture type investors, investments. And, you know, they might not go to a startup event or an angel investment pitch night. They're not plugged into the ecosystem, but that's okay, because what we're able to do is enable companies to open their opportunities to a national audience of investors and find their crowd, find the community to support them.
Whom would be the main recipients of this crowdsourced funding? Who are the most popular? What are the most popular industries?
That's a great question. And this is something that, you know, was borne out in the report, and that the report showed is that food and beverage was another strong year. Another year is the leading category for crowdsourced funding. And I think that there's a few reasons for that. Another interesting dynamic that we saw last year is, you know, craft brewers. The craft beer industry has been historically pretty active and achieved a lot of success with crowdsourced funding. These are businesses that people can understand, a large audience of people can understand. They're often businesses that people want to be associated with. I think for food and beverage, consumer packaged goods businesses, these markets can be very noisy and it's hard to differentiate. And what people have found is a really good way to do that is to source your capital from your customers who already know about your product. They can understand your business. You know, they're validating your business and what you're doing in a product sense as a customer. But for the businesses, it's not just the capital, but they're building a direct connection with, you know, often their most passionate customers by involving them in the business. But that's the low-hanging fruit for us, I think. You know, our goal as an industry and as a platform is to expand the footprint for crowdsource funding, because it works incredibly well for the things that we're really strong at. But we're 5 years into this industry now, and as a piece of legislation, it is incredibly flexible and there's a lot of value to add to other industries. And that we have been active in other industries, but we want to be more successful. So other, you know, innovative type industries are finding success with crowdsource funding. Later stage businesses that are perhaps approaching an IPO have found success on our platform. You know, there's a lot more that we can be doing and a lot more value to add.
I noticed that your report says that healthcare is a growing sector. That's interesting.
Because
sooner or later, mature investors will need to access healthcare. So they're going in for healthcare products.
Absolutely. And last year it was predominantly medicinal cannabis businesses in healthcare. And we've observed that there are a lot of thematic investors that are incredibly passionate about medicinal cannabis and other alternative medicines that I think it's a good thing that, you know, there is this focus, you know, on these types of alternatives for people now. I think this year we will start to see that expand to businesses that are in the psychedelics space. The recent downscheduling of psilocybin and MDMA for treatment-resistant depression and PTSD, and recent news of the first administration of these therapies to people in a clinical setting, a world first, I might add. It's a really exciting time for what I think will become a very big industry over the years, but certainly there is a lot of interest. People are interested in these things. And I think given the opportunity to support them with capital and be a part of their journey, it is something that certainly we've seen has been strong in the medicinal cannabis, and we expect it to continue to psychedelics and others.
What about sustainability?
Another really strong category. So what I mentioned of, you know, consumer packaged goods and food and beverage businesses, is often, I think, what people get preoccupied by in terms of what we're strong at is, you know, often founders will say to us, I'm not a B2C business. I don't have a product or service to an end consumer. So maybe this is not for me. But what we're seeing in the sustainability space is actually it's broader than that customer connection. It definitely gives a company a head start in terms of understanding what the natural audience for their offer will be. But it's actually more about storytelling. Is what you are doing interesting to a large group of people such that they want to support you and be part of your journey? And that's been, I think, a real strength for the sustainability category. So we've completed successful offers for, you know, companies like Seabin and ZeroCo. Seabin's a good example. They make a bin, it sits in the water, that collect waste plastic. but it's essentially public infrastructure. You or I would never buy a CBIN. It's like buying a street light. You know, it's kind of pointless, but people care about cleaning up the world's oceans. And this is an amazing way for companies like that to tell their story, build a community and raise capital.
What about the growth of Australia's tech industry? I mean, does that rate at all?
It does, but it's one of the areas that I think there's more that we could be doing and there's more that we want to do. And I think because the tech industry, there are investors that are active in that space already, that, you know, it takes time to change some of these normative practices. And I think we can add and be a very strong complement to that industry, but it's probably one of the areas that there are already people looking at these opportunities and supporting them. So the challenge and opportunity for us as a platform is how can we work collaboratively with tech and innovation investors to really kind of, you know, add firepower to these innovative tech companies.
Could I just make a suggestion that the tech people and your firm need to actually embark on educating people about their technology? Because I think there's a lot of, I mean, you have a lot of followers of technology, but they're a very small part of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get more people in, you'll have more investors, I think.
I completely agree. And I think more than that, it's the founders that are pursuing these endeavors that I am personally incredibly inspired by. And that's always my recommendation to founders is like, tell your story, because people invest in people. And this is what I think we're really good at and is helping people to tell their stories and find their audience. But when I'm explaining to others that are in the tech ecosystem that perhaps have these preconceived notions of what equity crowdfunding is, a way that I can explain what we do to them in a relevant way is, you know, highlight a really inspiring founder and say, wouldn't you love to back that person and invest in their business? Well, currently, you know, the only way you can do that is through an intermediary like a venture capital fund that you need to be a wholesale investor typically to, you know, invest through that. But if that founder had an opportunity on our platform, anyone in Australia would be able to invest up to $10,000 and support them. And there are amazingly inspiring stories from this industry that we need to tell more people. So I'm with you. We need to educate.
Now, one last question. What's the minimum a person can invest?
The most popular minimum parcel size is $250. So it's quite low, and some companies go lower than that, but certainly that's the most popular minimum parcel size. And it's important to talk about that because angel investment, typically without crowdsourced funding, you know, minimum investment sizes for these types of opportunities are, you know, in the tens of thousands of dollars. And like any investment, you need to be diversified. It is a risky asset class. Many of these things will not achieve the full extent of their ambition. But even in that, in a practical sense, being able to make smaller bets means it's far less expensive to achieve a, you know, sufficiently diversified portfolio. And I think it's an underappreciated benefit of what we do is that if there are enough quality companies that are operating in this space, then, you know, it makes it far more accessible for people to have a sensible allocation that is diversified as part of their investment, getting access to innovative Australian companies.
Well, Matt, we'll be watching very closely, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now let's talk to Indeed economist Callum Pickering.
Well, Callum, unemployment has picked up slightly to 4.1% in January. What's your take on that?
Well, it was a little bit of a surprising result. The labour market had obviously been easing somewhat. The unemployment rate had been trending upwards, but the jump was bigger than anticipated, certainly by the market and certainly by economists such as myself. So it was a relatively weak outcome, highlighted by the fact that employment jumped by only 500 people in the month. Which again was well short of market expectations. So overall, while the Australian labour market does remain very tight, with the unemployment rate quite low by historical standards, it was a somewhat disappointing set of labour market figures.
Oh, it was a two-year high, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The unemployment rate at a two-year high. Last time it was 4.1% was January of 2021. The expectation is that the unemployment rate is going to trend higher across the year. The Reserve Bank currently expects the unemployment rate will reach around 4.3% by year end. But I think it's worth noting that the current unemployment rate is actually tracking a little bit ahead of schedule in terms of what the RBA anticipated. So there's also the possibility that maybe the increase in unemployment is going to be larger than the RBA expects.
Would there be seasonal factors involved in that? Because a large number of workers would have started a new job after the holidays.
Yeah, there have been some changing seasonal hiring patterns, which I think has impacted the labour force figures over the past few months. It's impacted November, December, and likely January as well. And it does seem as though there was a higher than normal number of people who technically have jobs but haven't started those jobs yet. And so that could potentially influence the February figures. So if that was the case, we'd see a big boost in February, which would offset some of the weakness that we saw in January. Yeah, it's absolutely true that there has been some seasonal factors, which has maybe made the labour market figures a little bit more difficult to interpret than they traditionally have been.
What about hours worked?
Yeah, so it was down 2.5%. And again, seasonal factors could have contributed to this. So what we have noted in the past couple of years following the pandemic lockdown period was that a larger number of people than usual have been taking holidays during January period. So they're on leave. And what that is doing is it's pushing down hours worked, which is contributing to that factor. Now, nevertheless, if we take a step back and look at what hours worked have been doing since the middle of last year, the answer is not a lot. There hasn't been much movement in hours worked at all, which is a pretty weak outcome given that employment has been rising throughout that period. So we're not seeing the same movement on the hours side that we've been seeing on the employment side.
My interpretation of that is that firms are managing their workforce without significantly cutting their headcount.
Well, it's certainly a possibility, yes. They could be, you know, for workers who have more flexible schedules, they could be working a little less than they were traditionally. I mean, full-time workers tend to be a little bit more fixed in terms of the hours that they work, but there's certainly lots of flexibility on the part-time side. There is also the fact that over the past 12 months, around two-thirds of employment growth has been in part-time employment. So the quality of the jobs that have been created is not as high as it was in the past. So we might be seeing a lot of people enter the workforce and maybe they're working 15, 20 hours a week rather than, you know, 35 to 40 hours a week. And that could also be having some impact upon the hours work statistics.
Now, if the Reserve Bank is expecting unemployment to go up to 4.3%, that's going to have an impact on wages, wouldn't it?
Well, it is expected to. Now, an unemployment rate of 4.3% is still very low by historical standards. There's only been a few years in the past half century where we've had an unemployment rate lower than that. So we would still expect wage growth to be reasonably strong by historical standards. And of course, it's currently at 4%. It might go a little bit higher in the near term, but I'd expect it to settle well below that 4% rate, maybe down towards 3.5% at some point this year. So I still think that the wage growth is going to be reasonably strong this year. If the unemployment rate remains, well, if the unemployment rate is at, say, 4.3% by year end.
What impact would that have on the Reserve Bank?
Well, certainly the recent data flow has suggested that monetary policy is having the intended impact upon the economy. We're seeing weakness on the household spending. Inflation is obviously coming down and faster than anticipated. And we are seeing labour market conditions ease. So all the things are sort of suggesting that there isn't going to be much need for the Reserve Bank to hike rates again. And in fact, a lot of people are beginning to talk about the possibility of rate cuts maybe in the second half of this year. There are still some issues that the Reserve Bank would have, and they would like to see that change. Most notably is service sector inflation, which is still quite high. It's coming down, but it's still quite high. The Reserve Bank would like to see that come down a lot more this year, to be comfortable that they can consistently achieve that 2-3% inflation target. And they'd also be worried about productivity because wages and productivity are connected to what inflation typically looks like. And right now, wage growth is very high at 4%. Labour productivity is terrible. It's been negative. It's been absolutely dreadful over the past couple of years. which is meaning that essentially labor is more expensive, and that's feeding through to higher inflation. So if the Reserve Bank wants to achieve that 2-3% target, they need to see lower service sector inflation. They need to see higher productivity to offset those big wage gains that we have seen. And if that doesn't eventuate, then it's going to be very hard for them to achieve the target. And then they begin to think about monetary policy a lot differently.
You'd need productivity to go up to something like 1.5%, wouldn't you?
Yes, and that's what the Reserve Bank is currently, well, a little bit less. The Reserve Bank is forecasting a little bit less than that, 1.4% this year, down to around 1.2% over the next couple of years, which is the long-term average growth of productivity over, you know, the decade before the pandemic. That's what they think is going to happen. Of course, productivity growth has been negative in the past couple of years, so we're nowhere near that. But the RBA is anticipating that some of the disruptions to business operations are going to diminish over the coming year. So we're talking about...
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
You know, supply chain disruptions, global trade disruptions, Ukraine war, the impact that's having on fuel and electricity prices, and all those sort of factors are going to become less important going forward. And that's going to trigger productivity growth returning to something that better resembles normal. It represents a considerable risk to the RBA's economic forecasts. Definitely one thing that could fall well short of their expectations. And if that occurs, then inflation is likely to be higher than the RBA expects and remain higher for longer.
Well, Michelle Bullock, in her first press conference after the RBA decision, said the problem with inflation is it's got a 4 in front of it, which would mean you'd have to get inflation down to the low 3s before the RBA moves and cuts rates, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I would think so. But I do think we appear to be headed in that direction over the next 6 months, based on what we've been seeing with the monthly inflation measure, which is sort of a bit of a leading indicator for the quarterly measure that we tend to rely on a little bit more. That is suggesting that an unemployment rate in the mid 3% range is probably likely by mid-year, maybe getting down to 3% or maybe even slightly lower by the end of the year. Now, obviously, there's a ton of uncertainty around that. There's a lot of things that are going to change over the course of this year. But it does appear as though it is possible. You know, we can see light at the end of the tunnel in terms of inflation, but we need a few things to happen. And that productivity side of things is definitely one part of that equation, as of course is wages as well.
I would hazard a guess that with a lot of Australian companies adopting AI, that could boost productivity as well, potentially.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, there's also a lot of uncertainty around AI and how we're going to use it and the impact it's going to have on jobs. And there's a lot of fear out there as well. But the fact that a lot of Australian jobs are exposed to generative AI tools such as ChatGPT potentially means that they can use these tools in a way to boost productivity. So these tools do appear to have the capacity to fundamentally change the nature of work in Australia. But it's probably not going to happen overnight, obviously. This is, you know, sort of medium, long-term outlook. But it could certainly be productivity enhancing if it is used in the correct way.
So we're talking about months, if not years.
Well, I would say years more so than months. I mean, we are seeing businesses dip their toes in the water. They're exploring what these tools can do. But at the moment, certainly when I look at Indeed and how often these sort of tools are mentioned in job descriptions, it's not happening that often, which suggests that these jobs are not necessarily widespread just yet. but we certainly expect that usage within Australian businesses is going to increase quite rapidly over the next couple of years.
Well, Callum, thank you very much for your time again.
Thank you, Leon.
So what's happening in the news? An ANZ has won its $4.9 billion bid for Suncorp's banking arm on appeal, overturning regulatory concerns about the takeover squashing competition in the banking sector. The decision to allow the takeover was handed down on Tuesday morning by the Australian Competition Tribunal. It marks the largest merger deal in banking since the global financial crisis triggered the purchases of smaller banks by big four lenders, Westpac and Commonwealth Bank. The decision means Melbourne-based ANZ, one of Australia's big four banks, will boost its push into home loans by absorbing Brisbane-based Suncorp's middle-ranked banking arm, which is about $67 billion in loans. Suncorp will now continue as an insurer. It is already one of Australia's two biggest insurers of cars and homes under brands such as Dable AMI or GIO. The cash from ANZ will also potentially result in money flowing back to investors as special dividends or share buybacks. But the takeover could also raise some concerns from customers wary about a big four bank taking over smaller institutions and stoke concerns about whether Australian banking is too concentrated. And migrants coming to Australia boost productivity and lift the wages of all locals, especially those with fewer skills or less education, international research into the nation's immigration intake has revealed. Amid a growing debate about immigration, after a record number of people entered the country over the past 12 months, four separate research papers by the OECD show parts of Australia with higher flows of migrants gain an economic benefit of almost $1,500 a person. The new OECD research, based on the payroll records of 27 million people collated between 2011 and 2018, during which a net 1.7 million migrants moved into Australia, found those parts of the country with higher migrant numbers tended to have higher productivity levels. That enhanced productivity was driven in part by the migrants moving into those regions. The OECD found almost 60% of Australia's migrants had tertiary education compared to about 40% of the local born population. Migrants to Australia had much higher levels of tertiary education than those in other countries. The organisation's researchers found that on average, a 1 percentage point higher share of migrants were associated with higher productivity, worth $1,490 per person. A 1 percentage point increase in annual migrant numbers boosts the employment levels of locally born Australians by 0.53%. And the ABC's Four Corners has revealed that leaked emails show Coles has been profiting from higher prices at the checkout, despite repeated assurances from the supermarket giant that it is doing everything in its power to keep grocery bills down. The emails reveal for the first time the tactics Coles has employed with suppliers seeking a price increase and how it has taken advantage of inflation. Four Corners also revealed that Woolworths has used similar tactics to increase its profits over the last 18 months. Australia has a highly concentrated supermarket sector where Coles and Woolworths control 65% of the grocery market. The leaked emails show how supermarkets can exploit this lack of competition to push around suppliers, leading to higher grocery bills. The emails showed Coles received a one-off payment from a multinational supplier for allowing a price increase, then passed on this cost to customers. The price increase of around 5%, which the supplier sought to cover its rising costs, was initially dismissed by the Coles buyer based on customer needs and the competitive environment. Four Corners also revealed that about 18 months ago, Woolworths began trying to increase its own profit margins using economy-wide inflation as cover. Woolworths asked to share in any price increases granted to its suppliers. It would do this by requesting its supplier to pay some of this price increase back to Woolworths. That meant consumers ended up paying more. Suppliers did not get the full price increase, but Woolworths increased its profit margins. Woolworths buys a product at $2 and sells it for $3. It gets a 33% gross profit margins. Normally, if a supplier got its increase, Woolworths buys for $2.20 and sells for $3.30. Woolworths keeps its 33% margin. Everyone gets the same amount of the pie. But if Woolworths buys at $2.10 and sells for $3.30, it increases its margins to 36.4%. Shoppers pay more, but Woolworths passes on a smaller share of that to suppliers. Woolworths Chief Executive Bram Banducci, who retired from the supermarket giant this week after 13 years with Woolworths, including 8.5 years as CEO, said the company did not employ these tactics. Woolworths' latest annual report shows that last financial year, its pre-tax profit margins from selling groceries rose from 5.3% to 6%. That increase was worth an extra $318 million in profit last year alone. At the same time, its cost of doing business was flat. Mr. Banducci denied this was evidence of price gouging. Star Entertainment is on the verge of losing a lucrative license to operate one of two Sydney casinos after the New South Wales regulator launched an independent inquiry into whether the company had fixed major cultural failures. Adam Bell SC, the Sydney barrister who conducted an early inquiry into Star's Sydney casino, had been appointed to run the review, a decision that blindsided the company's executive when it was announced on Monday morning. Mr. Bell's 2022 report found Star was unsuitable to hold its license, describing its operations as a case study of unethical conduct and cultural failure that may have evaded taxes and facilitated $900 million of banned gambling transactions. Over 4 months, his inquiry revealed Star hid criminal junket operator Sun City's illegal cash cage and allowed it to operate a secret gambling room. Star and his chief executive, Robbie Cook, did not respond except to note the review, which will run in private and conclude in May. The first Bell review, along with a similar investigation in Queensland, where Star operates casinos in Brisbane and the Gold Coast, led to the resignation of key figures, including the company's chief executive, Matt Beggier. Star's market capitalization has shrunk by more than $2.4 billion to $1.6 billion since the start of the first Bell inquiry, and shares were suspended from trade on Monday. Still, the Sydney casino has been lucrative, with gaming revenues of $838.9 million last year. The new review will consider whether Star has enough money to operate properly, as well as its management, reporting lines and compliance with internal controls. The regulator said it was concerned about how much of a remedial action was due to the actions of a state-appointed special manager, rather than being driven by the company. The Bell inquiry went into extensive details about the cultural failings of the company. It described the culture as one which condoned unethical conduct, prioritised business goals over compliance objectives, courted risk and discouraged bad news. In his report, Mr. Bell noted areas that needed investigation, including the continuation and promotion of staff who are part of the culture that enabled misconduct. The cultural dysfunction had significant adverse consequences for Star's capacity to withstand the risks of criminal infiltration and money laundering, he wrote. The financial crime watchdog is also suing Star, alleging it allowed 117 high-risk VIP patrons to churn billions of dollars of dirty cash through its casinos for years. Sun City, the Macau-headquartered junket operator alone, turned over $15.5 billion and players recorded a total loss of more than $150 million between December 2016 and September 2020, the Australian Transaction Reports and Analysis Centre alleged in filings with the federal court. And Seven Group, controlled by billionaire Kerry Stokes and his family, wants to buy all of Boral and has made an offer for the remaining 28.4% it does not currently control in a bid to bring the concrete and asphalt company inside the diversified industrial. Seven Group already owns Westcoats Hire Business, Westrac Mining Trucks and Machinery, and 30% of oil and gas group Beach Energy. It holds 71.6% of Boral after 2021 takeover attempt. Boral has made a strong turnaround under Chief Executive Vic Bansal, hired by the Stokes family in late 2022. Ryan Stokes, son of Kerry Stokes, is the chairman of Boral and the chief executive of Seven. The Stokes family, since taking control in 2021, heavily influenced a shift in strategy for Boral to become an Australia-focused business, exiting in North America, where it sold off $4 billion in assets. The integration of Boral as a 100% owned business is a natural evolution for Seven Group, Ryan Stokes said on Monday, describing its offer as best and final. It will not pay more than $6.25 for Boral shares for at least 12 months. Seven Group Chairman Terry Davis said its offer was attractive because it would facilitate dividends via the equity component. Boral has not paid a dividend for 2 years, and through a combination of limited franking credits and a significant investment program, is unlikely to pay dividends for some time, Mr. Davis said. The letter from Mr. Davis also outlined Seven's intentions to push for more board representation of Boral in line with its existing 71.6% stake and to steer the strategy further towards reinvesting free cash flow into long-term growth strategies, such as upgrading its transport fleet and replacing short-life quarries. That would further constrict any plans by Boral to pay dividends. Boral urged shareholders to take no action. The independent board committee notes the continued strong performance of the Boral business and the management team, the statement said. And the profit reporting season continues. Woolworths posted a massive loss of $781 million after the company bulked 1.6 billion New Zealand dollars, that's 1.5 billion Aussie, write down in the value of its New Zealand grocery business, and a $209 million reduction in the value of a stake in ASX-listed alcohol and hotel spin-off Endeavour. But excluding those one-offs, Woolworths announced a 2.5% rise in half-year profit to $929 million. That was based on a 4.4% increase in revenue compared to the same period a year earlier. BHP's US $6.6 billion, that's $20.1 billion Aussie, underlying profit crashed to just US $927 million. Westpac reported net profit of $1.5 billion, down 6%. National Australia Bank's cash earnings dived 16.9% in the December quarter to $1.8 billion. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank's net profit was up 13.8% to $282.3 million. Cochlear reported its underlying net profit was up 35% to $191.8 million. A2 Milk Company's profit rose 15.6% to 85.3 million New Zealand dollars. Lendlease's pre-tax loss widened to $173 million from $122 million. Reliance Worldwide posted a 23.4% slump in its interim profit to US $51.1 million, that's $78 million Aussie. Australia's largest steel manufacturer, Blue Soap Steel, reported a net profit of $439 million for the 6 months to December 31, down $160 million on a year earlier. Ampol reported a 25% drop in statutory profit to $549.1 million in the 12 months of December, down from $795.9 million in the previous year. However, Ampol's replacement cost operating profit, the company's preferred metric, which removes the rise and fall in oil prices, rose 1.1% to $740.1 million. ASX-listed landlord and fund manager GPT Group recorded a full-year 2023 statutory loss of $240 million. The construction and product supplier GWA Group posted total NPAT from ordinary activities 8.9% to $23.2 million Aussie. Nuix has reported a first-half loss of $4.8 million. Australian packaging manufacturers Aurora's statutory NPAT amounted to $68.2 million, down $39.9 million. Investment platform Hub24 reported a 39% increase in statutory net profit after tax to $21.5 million in the first half of 2024. Baby Bunting's first net profit was flat in the first half at $2.7 million. Engineering company Monadelphous Group reported a 3.2% increase in net profit to $30.1 million. Sonic Healthcare reported a 47% slump in half-year net profit to $202 million. Tech company Megaport's net profit was $4.4 million from a $13.5 million loss a year ago. Judo Bank reported a profit before tax of $67 million for the first half of 2024, up 24% from the prior half-year. Metals recycling company Sims reported $65.8 million in NPAT, and underlying earnings dropped 86% to $13.4 million. Insurance group at AUB Group reported $53.1 million in net profit after tax in the first half of 2024 from a loss of $2.2 million a year earlier. Ansell's profit before interest and tax slid 14.5% to US $78.2 million. Financial services firm Netwealth posted a 28.3% profit increase in the first half of 2024 compared to the previous corresponding period, posting a profit of $39.3 million. Car accessory makers ARB posted a 21% increase in reported profit before tax to $71 million in the first half of 2024. Coal miner Coronado Global Resources reported an 80% drop in net income in the first half of 2024 to $156 million. Buy now, pay later operator Humm Group entered the first half FY24 with cash profit after tax $28.1 million, down $10.4 million on the corresponding period of FY23. Travel agency Corporate Travel Management's net profit was recorded at $57.9 million. Domino's Pizza Enterprises' net profit fell by 9.2% to $58 million in the 6 months ended December 31. Software provider WiseTech posted a 5% increase in statutory net profit to $118.2 million. Westfield owner and operator Centre has recorded a 41.8% drop in its annual statutory profit to $174.9 million. Oil and gas giants Santos posted a 42% dip in underlying net profit to US $1.423 billion, that's $2.2 billion Aussie, for the year to December 31. Stockland posted a half-year profit of $102 million. property fund manager Charter Hall has swung to a $190 million loss in 2024 first half. The Lottery Corporation has boosted profit by more than 26% to $217.4 million. Ventia Services' annual net profit slipped just under 1% to $189.8 million. Iluka Resources reported net profit of $342.6 million for the 12 months through December, down 41% from $599 million a year earlier. Iris has reported statutory NPAT loss of $137 million in FY23 compared to a profit of $52.7 million in FY22. National Storage REI posted an IFRS profit after tax of $79.2 million. Peter Warren Automotive posted a profit before tax of $34.4 million. Smart Group Corporation posted an NPAT of $63.2 million, up 3%. Viva Energy posted a net profit after tax of $318.2 million, up 46.7%. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Richard Kirkman, the CEO of Veolia. Research undertaken by Veolia, the nation's leader in ecological transformation, found that climate distress and eco-anxiety have become the norm in Australia, with the majority of Aussies playing emphasis on the role the businesses must play in addressing these issues. And I'll be talking to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver about the profit reporting season. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from our website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week and looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.